70s with Montgomery and Dyson and the pair correlation. Then Odlyzko, probably in the 80s, made these computations that these stunning pictures that you've seen that really convinced people that everything was accurate. Then I would say in the early 90s, things weren't happening really too fast, but in the early 90s, Hedgehall worked out sort of triple correlation for zeros of zeta function for limited test functions and compared that with triple correlation for GUE. And then about the same time, Rudnick and Sarnak did N correlation, same thing. And pretty much that was about most of what had happened, I would say, up until around, the period 96 to 98 to 2000, kind of in there, when there were two events that really sparked the theory. And one was the work of John Keating and Nina Snaith about moments, and the other was the work of Katz and Sarnak about families. They're both KS, Keating, Snaith, Katz, Sarnak, but I think that's just a coincidence. Anyway, what Katz and Sarnak did was they looked at function field zeta functions. They constructed families of these things where you know the Riemann hypothesis. You can calculate statistics of zeros, and they verified that the statistics they got for these function field zeta functions really came from random matrix theory. And that was quite an event. It introduced this idea of families of L functions. And that's what I want to focus on is the Katz-Sarnak stuff. Now, there's a couple things. One, we've heard that in the physics literature, we've heard about beta equals 1, 2, and 4 being the Gaussian orthogonal, Gaussian unitary, and Gaussian symplectic ensembles. Well, what Katz and Sarnak found is that for the number theory applications, what you need are the eigenvalues of the classical compact groups, the orthogonal group, the unitary group, and the symplectic group. Now, the statistics for the unitary group did agree with the CUE or GUE statistics, but the statistics for the orthogonal group with Haar measure and for the symplectic group with Haar measure are actually different than the things that were studied by the physicists. And so Katz and Sarnak basically went through and redid a lot of the, say, the physics literature in their own style, of course, and proved rigorously sort of everything we need to know about the statistics for orthogonal and symplectic groups that arose in their study of function fields. And that is actually about the only source that's available for this material. And some people have found their book slightly hard to read. And what I'm going to attempt to do in a couple lectures is to go through a lot of what's in the first eight chapters of Katz and Sarnak, just kind of distill it down to give you the essence of what's in there, and hopefully that'll make it maybe a little bit more accessible, especially for mathematicians, I think. I think a lot of this stuff is very familiar to the physicists, and they would know exactly how to do all this, but maybe it's a little harder for the mathematicians. I'm giving four lectures. So the first couple or two and a half will be on the Katz and Sarnak statistics for these groups. And then I'll give some examples of families of L functions. And in the last lecture, look at low-lying zeros of families of L functions and show that up to a certain point, they agree with the density, the one-level density functions for eigenvalues of these groups. And today, I hope to actually get through and calculate with pretty much full details the n-level density functions for these groups. So let's see how this works. And there will be notes available as well as more slide copies pretty soon. So let's see. Okay, so we're going to be looking at the unitary group, UN, the orthogonal groups. Actually, both SO2N and SO2N plus 1 are going to split up into even and odd orthogonal and the unitary symplectic. And I'm going to denote these sort of through the things by U, O and O minus, and I'm going to use P for here because we have S's appearing all over the place. And so I decided to try and use a P and see how that works. You should notice, actually, some of the difficulty in getting into the subject is just between, just, you know, the language between mathematicians and physicists. I always was taught to use U star for conjugate transpose, but I believe in John's lecture, U star was just conjugate, right? So there's already a difference right there on the very first slide between how I'm using U star and how John is, but anyway. Right. So these are the definitions of the compact groups that we're interested in. And as John said, they all have eigenvalues on the unit circle. For UN, we'll go between 0 and 2 pi. For these other groups, they have symmetric eigenvalues. And so really, there's just n independent ones for SO2N. And SO2N plus 1, you have an eigenvalue at 1 as well. So we've got 1 and then pairs. And then for the symplectic group, same thing. So each of these four groups, written like that, has sort of n independent eigenvalues. And John talked about the Haar measure on the unitary group. And so I want to talk about it on all four groups here. And those are the formulas that you get for Haar measure. Now I'm going to use, instead of d mu Haar, I decided to use just d-u-n, d-o-n. And so this means the Haar measure for the orthogonal group SO2N, and here for SO2N plus 1, and here for USP2N. Okay, so those are the formulas for Haar measures. Now, I'm not going to prove that these are the Haar measures, but I'm going to do something even better. Show that, in fact, all of these things have total mass 1. So we'll verify that rigorously, that the mass of each of these things, when you integrate over, if you take each one of these formulas and integrate over the full group, that you get one in every case.
Can you just clarify that the orthogonal group would be 7 plus 1 or minus 1?
Right.
Just break up into 2?
Yeah, so that's why we're breaking it up, because this, the characteristic polynomials of these things have determinant plus 1 and the characteristic polynomial, or yeah. The determinant is 1 for these matrices. Sorry, the determinant is 1, but the characteristic polynomial has a functional equation which has a minus in this case and a plus in this case. I'm sorry, that's why they're split up like that. Yeah, I had slides on with the characteristic polynomials, and then for some reason, I got rid of them. And then I realized I shouldn't have done that. But anyhow, that's why that split up like that. Okay. Okay, and the way we use this, these formulas. So here, for example. So this is exactly what John said. We have the Weyl integration formula, but now we have four of them. If you have a class function and you want to integrate it with respect to the Haar measure, then you change it, in this case, into just an n-fold integral on 0 pi, and you include this extra factor like that. So that just comes, that's what we mean by these. So in some sense, for what I do, you don't actually need to know that these things are Haar measures. You could just think of them as just a sequence of probability distributions given on either 0 pi to the n or 0 2 pi to the n. And each one has, if you integrate over all of them, you get total mass 1. Okay? We need to rewrite these Haar measures into forms that are going to be more useful for calculation. And the first step in doing that is Vandermonde determinants. We've already seen these several times. If you have a sequence of numbers x1 through xn, then the Vandermonde is just a determinant of xk's to the j minus 1s. So you have a top row of 1s, and then x1, x2 up to xn, and then x1 squared up to xn squared, and so on. The last row is x1 to the n minus 1, and so on. And that factors as a product like that. There may be some difference in sign in some of the earlier lectures. I'm not sure. I know some people see this is written with a xk minus xj. Anyway, this is the way I'm going to write them. And the proof is that, in fact, when you look at this determinant form, you see the determinant vanishes whenever two x's are equal, because then the rows are the same. And so you have, certainly this is a factor. It agrees with the degree of the Vandermonde. And in fact, if you look at, a diagonal term, it's easy to see that a coefficient is 1 in both cases. And that nails the thing down. And let's see. Well, so the way we're going to... maybe I'll just leave that up for a second more. The way we're going to use that Vandermonde is initially then to rewrite those products from the Haar measures. These things squares are squares of Vandermonde. There's a misprint there. That should be an absolute value on the... And that same note, of course, on your notes, it's of course the same. Okay, now here's the thing that's going to allow us to calculate the. Well, here's one way to calculate the measure of all of these things. It's this thing that I have been calling Graham's identity up until a couple days ago, and then Estelle told me this should be called Andreev's identity, right? And so it goes back to 1883. Seems to be a very useful, nice little identity. And it's just what we need to, in conjunction with the Vandermonde, to compute. We'll just compute that all these things average to 1 for each n. Okay, so you have some interval j, and you have functions phi j and psi j. When we use it, either psi j will either be equal to phi j or else to phi j bar, basically. And so you integrate a product of determinants, and what you get is this determinant with the integral on the inside. And there's a proof in the notes, and I'll show you a proof, I think, in a couple minutes. But let's see. I guess I can go ahead and get rid of this now. Okay, so on these Haar measures, notice you've got... Well, okay, so for these three, they all have this cosine product with square, and then this one doesn't have any signs. This has sine squared of theta over 2s, and that has sine squareds of thetas. The normalization constants, slightly different for O of n, but the same here for O minus and symplectic. Okay, so there's the calculation using Andreev's identity that for the unitary group you get 1. And let's see if we can do this. So we're trying to maybe I should put the, I have everything I need here. Let's see. Okay, so this is, yeah, all right. So we want to integrate over 0 to pi to the n of dun. And the idea is to show that that's 1. That's what I mean by saying the total mass of the thing is 1. So the Haar measure is the square of the Vandermonde. So here I've replaced the Haar measure by the Vandermonde square here. And then that's the stuff that's out front. And using phi j is e to the I j minus 1 theta. Oh, I guess I should say, and psi j is the conjugate. Then you can bring the integral inside, and you just have phi j and psi k. But this is, as John was talking about, this just, you're integrating over 0 to pi e to the I n theta for some n, and that's 0 unless n is 0, in which case it's 1. And so all you get is when j is k here, you just get the identity, and then times 2 pi. And so you have 2 pi to the n, and that cancels that out. Notice the n factorial here, right? That disappears in Andreev's identity. You have a 1 over n factorial here, but it goes away out there. And so that's nice, simple proof. And using this Andreev identity, that these things all have measure 1. Yeah?
Yes?
Okay, so we're applying this thing, right? So we're trying to, at this line right here, we're trying to apply this identity. So I think it is equal. I think psi j is equal to the conjugate then, right? Because we basically have phi j. We take the mod square of the determinant and write it as, you know, the determinant of phi j and then the determinant of phi j bar. Oh, that's a psi. Sorry, Right. Sorry. I noticed that I had forgotten to define psi, and so I was trying to write that up. And you'll see that this Andreev's identity is quite simple to prove. It's just something you could do in your linear algebra class. Okay. Now we need we can't apply this straight to the other measures. We need to get them into a better form first. And so we do that through the use of orthogonal polynomials, and we've also heard about those last week and how they get used in the GUE in Jan's talks with the Hermite polynomials. And what we're going to have here are the Chebyshev polynomials. So Tn of cos theta equals cos n theta. That defines a degree n polynomial, Tn, just the usual nth Chebyshev polynomial. Un cos theta is sine n plus 1 theta over sine theta. And then Vn will be sine of n plus half theta over sine theta over 2. And it's easy, well known, to calculate that that each one of these is a gives you a degree n polynomial. The leading coefficients of Tn, Un, and Vn are given by that. In the notes, I have that written out a little bit more. If we, for T, we have a little bit of a problem with T1 being 1. Its mod square integrates to something different than, say, T1 of cosine theta. So T1 of x is x. T1 of cosine theta would be cosine squared theta. If you integrate that over 0 pi, you get pi over 2, whereas if you integrate 1 over 0 pi, you get pi. And we want them all to be the same. So we just multiply. If for 1, we leave it alone, but for bigger n's, we multiply by square root of 2. And then this gives us orthogonal polynomials on 0 pi with respect to, well, that one just with respect to the d theta, the u with respect to sine squared theta d theta, and the v with respect to sine squared theta over 2 d theta. So we're going to use the t star for orthogonal, and then the v for O minus, and the u for p, for the symplectic. Okay? And the point here is that all the tj stars have the same size. When you integrate them, when you integrate it with respect to d theta, you always get pi. For the uj's, you always get pi over 2, and for the vj's, pi over 2. But the point is, within each group, it's the same. So it's like if we scaled out by root pi and root 2 over pi and so on, and be orthonormal, be an orthonormal basis. Okay. So, and then, what you do is you just use elementary row operations to write the van der Mond as determinants of, you have three different things you can do, determinants of with these orthogonal polynomials. So, delta of cos theta 1 up to cos theta n is equal to 1, 1, 1, and then cos theta 1, cos theta 2, cos theta n, cos squared theta 1, cos squared theta 2, and so on up to cos squared theta n. Well, you can take linear combinations of the rows and just add them on appropriately so that what you wind up with is, you know, polynomials in all of these things. And so you can, if you just do it the right way, just add up things the right way, you wind up with exactly these polynomials. And the factors of 2 out front are just reflective of the leading coefficients in each of these things. Okay? So we have three useful ways to write that van der Mond. And so then just translating back to our harm measures, we now write them as squares of determinants. And we've got, okay, so is that all clear? So you just use elementary row operations and you wind up with those things. Okay, so now we can compute the mass of ON. So, right. So I've already applied. Okay. So I'm applying. So I'm taking this thing, and now I'm going to apply Andreev's identity. Maybe I should put that back up. I think I should put numbers on these slides, Chris. I'm never going to get them back in order again. All right, so we're going to apply Andreev's in this case. So we're integrating a product of determinants, but now the determinant has these tj minus 1 stars, and so we can bring the integral on the inside, and, got a mistake here, too. The n factorial is supposed to go away. All right. Okay, forget that. We got rid of the n factorial. in Andreas' identity. And then these things were orthonormal, and they just integrated to pi, and so you get the pi to the n, and that kills out pi to the n. All right. Now, here's another form of Andreas' identity where you can put an extra little function in here, a product of functions, and it still works the same way. If you do this, the same identity, but now you put a product of f of theta i's, that can also get into that determinant on the inside with an f of theta. And so we can use that to get the other two then. The other two to have measure one. Okay? So we have this improved version. And then the calculations look much the same. I didn't make the mistake of putting 1 over n factorial here. So we have the v's, and we have the sine squared theta over 2. But remember, the v's are orthogonal with respect to the measure sine squared theta over 2 d theta. Is that what I mean to say? Yeah, that's right. And so, their norms were pi over 2, and so we just get a contribution when j is k here, and we get a pi over 2, and so we get pi over 2 to the n, and that cancels out that one there. And then same thing, the uj's, these Chebyshev polynomials are orthogonal on 0 pi with respect to sine squared theta, and they also integrate when j equals k to pi over 2, and so you get that. All right. So let me see. If I can do this. All right. So now let's do the proof of Andreev's identity. So I think it's broken down. I guess this is an okay way to put it up here. Right, so, so we want to integrate this product of determinants. And so what we do is we expand each determinant into its permutation sum. So we sum over all the permutations, and then we get products of things. That's the first step. So this sum will be over, I think I've been using pi n for the symmetric group. So the symmetric group, the group of permutations, symmetric group of permutations of numbers from 1 to n. Usually that's Sn, but like I said, there's just way too many S's floating around here. But I guess I don't have pi n on the slides anyway. It's in the notes. But that's what the sigma is over all the permutations in pi n. And how do you do a determinant? Well, you sum over all the permutations, you take the sine of the permutation, and then you take a product. J goes from 1 to n, phi j of theta sub sigma j, right? That's how you do. That's how you expand out a permutation, a determinant. And then same thing with for this one. Now it'll be a tau and d theta. And now the pi n is a group, and so we can make changes of variables. So like we can let tau go to sigma tau, and then the new tau still varies over the group, the pi n. So now we have sigma tau, and then we have a sine of sigma and a sine of sigma tau, and so the sine of sigmas cancel out, and you just get a sine of tau left. And now we got product j and k. So phi j, that's still there, and psi k of, well, tau went to sigma tau, so that's now sigma tau k. Now let k go to tau inverse of k. Is this thing focused okay? I guess it's clearer at the top than the bottom, isn't it? So now let replace k by tau inverse k. And so now it's a psi sub tau inverse k. And that tau k became a tau tau inverse k. So that's now just a theta of sigma k. Now I'm not sure why I wanted this one over here. I thought I had it written as left side equals right side, but I guess not. So, and then now where are we? Psi tau inverse. Right. Let's see. You know, I think this is maybe not written quite right. This product over J and K. Really, I think this makes more sense to write this as a product over J and then a product over K. I mean, otherwise there's an ambiguity if the sort of J's are just floating around when you're doing the K product. So I think that was not really written. Yeah, I shouldn't have combined that that J and K on that term. So keep those things separate because that's the whole point of the next. Of the next equation, right? Because, right? Because we don't really need two variables, J and K. See, the I mean, this might as well be a this K might as well be a J, and that's all we've done. And now it's just one product, but with both of the things, and then one more little. Change of variables here. Tau goes to tau inverse. Well, the sign doesn't change, and well, that just makes that look a little nicer with a tau there. Okay, and now the point is that you've got the exact same theta here and here, and so when you do the integral, this means that in any column, you're going to have the exact same theta. So when you bring the, you can bring the, when you look at these things that you're integrating, you might as well just, it's an integral of a product of things that split up, and so that's a product of integrals. So you might as well just make these d thetas, and that's how you get the, that's how you get the integral on the inside. And now, at this point, then the sigma is completely gone because the last place it was left was in that theta, so you just have n factorial, and then that thing's a determinant. So, all right. Now, okay. Now this is well, I call this thing the transposing lemma. That's kind of a stupid name. But this is the exactly what we saw in Jan's lectures, where you have a product of two determinants, and we just saw it in John's lecture too. And you take the transpose of one, and then multiply the things, and so we've already seen this a couple times. You have a product of determinants like this, and you can make it as into a determinant of a sum on the inside of these functions. Well, right, that's just because of because the determinant of a transpose is the transpose of the determinant. And so, right, so you can write the thing like this. Here I've written, okay, this Jn here is supposed to mean that, that the Jn, you know, it's a determinant of this matrix where we're thinking of this as the Jn entry. This is the Jn entry. And this is the NK entry. And so when you write it like that, then the product of the two things just gives you the sum. And so you have that. Okay, so that's a simple thing. And then We do that for, we started with the Haar measure, and then we used Vandermonde and orthogonal polynomials and got the Haar measures as squares of determinants. And now we're going to use this little transposing lemma and we did this Andreev's identity and verified that everything had mass 1. And now we'll use this lemma to write everything as a determinant, not a square determinant, but just a determinant of stuff. Okay? And, so these are the relevant determinants that we're interested in. And so you do that. We've already actually seen that. Here, then, you have Tn stars of cos theta j. So instead of having a product of determinants, we have the determinant of this sum. And then if you go back to the definitions of the Chebyshev polynomials, this just becomes this, with the sum of cosines. And same thing for the symplectic is what this is going to be useful for. You got a determinant of a sum of sines, and then for the O minus, it winds out to that. Okay, so that's just using that transposing lemma. And so now we can rewrite our Haar measures just as determinants. Oops. Okay, so nothing's happened there, just rewriting this. And then now we just want to add up these trigonometric sums. And they can all be expressed in terms of this basic function Sn of theta. So here's where all the Sn's start showing up. Sine n theta over 2 divided by sine theta over 2. And so we just have these four identities. And those are just, standard. And then if we define these S's to be sort of just the things that you have on the right side over here, except for the first one, we don't really like this factor here. That's going to disappear. And so we'll just have this. And so we call these things then SU, SO, SO minus, and SP. And I have to say, some of the notation I'm using here is not standard. I've just made it up. But not all the notation in Katz and Sarnak is exactly standard. And I'm hoping that this is a better, maybe in some cases this might be a reasonable sort of set of notations for studying these things. And so this is what we wind up with then. Okay, so now we're happy with our forms for Haar measures. And we're ready to begin calculating statistics. Now there's four statistics that we're going to be interested in. And they're going to be, we'll call them N-level density, N-correlation, nearest neighbor, or jth nearest neighbor, if you like, and jth lowest eigenvalue. Okay, so those are going to be the four statistics that we're interested in. And what happens for these groups, I'll just tell you ahead of time, two of them, you get sort of the same answer for all three groups, and two of them, you get different answers for the different groups. So the neighbor spacings and the correlations are the same for all three of these groups. Okay, now this is different from sort of the physics literature, where you have the beta equals 1, 2, and 4, also have names orthogonal, unitary, and symplectic, but this is a contrast to what happens in those situations. Okay? So in the situation we're interested in, the neighbor spacing and the correlation functions are the same for all three groups, whereas the density functions and the jth lowest eigenvalue statistics are different for, I'm saying three, we actually have four things here. For all four, well, I guess they're not always, well, okay, they're in general different for the three groups. Okay, so in particular, yeah. When n tends to infinity, yeah, we're going to be looking at the large n limit of these things, right? Well, I haven't even said what they are, so, but yeah, that's right. So in particular, the one-level density, which really just amounts to, that's the thing that we're going to be looking at. If you have your eigenvalues, eigenangles theta, well, if you just sort of sum, take some test function f of theta, and sum n goes from 1 to n, f of theta. Let's say that f, or let's say that theta is associated with u, and you integrate that over the unitary group, and you let the limit as n goes to infinity, or whatever group here. Then that's the thing. What we're interested in is that this thing equals an integral from say 0 to infinity. F of x times times some function. I've forgotten what I've called it. Let's say w1 of x dx. So if for all for reasonable f, we have this kind of situation, then we'll call f, then we'll call w. Sub 1 is the one-level density function. I'm definitely getting ahead of myself. Sorry, this has to be scaled, in this case, times n over 2 pi. Yeah. Okay, well, we'll talk about that in a second. But so basically, this is one, the one that we're going to be interested in is W1, because that's what we can compute for families of L functions. And since you get different answers for the different groups, then when we look at sort of the big L functions where the Katz and Sarnak conjectures are expected to still hold, there's an analog for them, but we'll be able to distinguish between the different families of L functions that were for which we're calculating these statistics, because we're going to get different answers to these. All right. Okay, so correlation and neighbor the same, density and lowest eigenvalues are different. And that's a contrast that's different from the physics literature. It's different than what happens in the circular ensembles. Okay, now the main thing that you need to get going is Godin's lemma. And you know, that was in Jan's talk. Is Jan still here? I don't know. I think that was in his talk. I think he called it Godin and Maeda. I guess I'm not exactly sure what the... I haven't actually looked at the original sources here, so I don't know. But anyway, we're going to call it Godin's lemma. And this is the thing that allows you to get off the ground. And here it's written in just kind of a general setting. You have some function f, and let's say the an interval, a set j, integral over j, f of x theta, f of theta y, d theta. Suppose that gives you f of x, y back all the time, except for a constant c. This is a thing that Jan called the reproducing property. And suppose also that the integral on the diagonal is d, then the integral of a m by m determinant with f of theta j, theta k, can be reduced to a the integral of the m by m determinant with respect to the last variable, the theta m variable, reduces to an m minus 1 by m minus 1 determinant with, you know, just the last variable removed, and you get this factor, this d minus m minus 1 times c. Okay? Okay, now, yeah.
Where's You have absolute value of points around the J, but not in the omega.
Oh. Yeah, sorry. I've been working on these slides and constantly editing them and changing them, maybe a little too much. And here we go. It's in my pocket. So I had this originally written with minuses, f of x minus theta, f of theta minus y, and then I decided to change it into comma. And in that case, then this d was just f of 0 times the measure of d. And so that's, yeah. J does still denote the measure of d, but yeah, it's not really needed for this formula. All right, so let's just verify. So this slide says that our functions are, these S things, which are for the determinants of these S things, give us the hard measures, right? And this is just verifying, it's just stating that these have these reproducing properties. I've sort of just written it as, well, here G is just supposed to be any one of those three that goes over 0 pi, and this is the U one. And this is the proof in the case of, that's not the proof. Hang on a second. That's on the next slide. And this is then just writing. I'll prove this in a second. Here's how it works with SGN. The reproducing stuff does work with the constant C equals pi and D equals N pi. So when you put in, when you put those in to the lemma, you get this. And now if you apply this first with m equals n, you have a full n by n determinant, and you're just integrating out the last variable, then you get a factor 1 here, and n minus 1 by n minus 1 determinant. Then you apply it with m as n minus 1, and that'll reduce it to an m minus 2 by m minus 2 determinant, and so on. And you pick up the factors 1, 2, 3, and so on. And if you do this all the way to n plus 1, then you have the result that integrating all but the first little n variables over this determinant gives you pi to the n minus n times n minus n factorial. Okay, so that's how we're going to apply Godin's. That's how we're going to apply this lemma, is you do it repeatedly to get to this thing. Okay, and let's see. So here's a verification that these S's do satisfy the reproducing thing. We just use the orthogonality. So for P, this is what SP looks like. And so if we integrate SP x theta against SP theta y, we'll have 4 times sine x sine y times the integral 0 to pi, sum over m and n. So I've changed from subscript n minus 1. I just shifted to n, because once I put n minus 1 on here, the formula didn't fit on the slide anymore. So un cos x, un cos theta, um cos theta, um cos y, and then we had the sine squared theta, because theta was, you know, one of the x's or y's in each of these. So that's so now you integrate and you use your orthogonality. You're just integrating with respect to theta, so only these two in the middle count. And the only time anything happens is when m equals n, and you integrate against the sine squared, and so you just get pi over 2. And you have that left, and that 4 over 2, that gives you a 2 pi times that, and then that's pi times that thing. So that's just the verification that these S's reproduce in the way that you want them to. Let me put this here. Okay, and so now, so I'm going to give you a proof of Godin's lemma, but not probably not today, maybe tomorrow. But let's use Godin's lemma now to compute n-level density. Okay, and so first, let's just look at this another rewriting of Godin's lemma. Suppose that, okay, so B is going to denote a little n-sized subset of 1 through n. And if f is a symmetric function of little n variables, then by f theta b, we just mean f theta b1 up to f theta bn, where b is that set with n's. Now, see, it doesn't matter what order b is written in, because, I mean, it's a set, and f is symmetric, so this notation's okay. And if you then sum over all the little n-sized subsets and integrate that with respect to dun, then what happens? Well, basically, how many of these subsets are there? Well, there's n choose n. There's big N choose little n of these subsets, and they all give the same answer. Because you just integrate whatever variables, whatever the theta b's that are involved, you just integrate out all the rest of the variables. Okay, and so the answer is always going to be for each one of those things, using this right here, you're just going to get the integral. You might as well just take theta 1 through theta n of the n by n determinant. Well, in this case, this is for SU. What happened to this n minus n factorial? Well, see, it gets multiplied by n choose n, because that's the number of subsets there are of size n, which is n factorial divided by n minus n factorial times little n factorial. And so that cancels, and the 1 over n factorial that goes along with the Haar measure definition for U of n, that gets canceled by this, and so you're just left with 1 over little n factorial. Okay, so what does this mean? Well, you take some test function f and sum it, a function of little n variables, and you sum it over all the different choices of thetas, of little n thetas that you can get out of the big N thetas, and then you average it. And this is what you get. Okay, so we're thinking of f as being so the next thing we're going to do is let big N go to infinity in this picture. But here we have an exact formula for what happens for finite n, and you just get this. So this is the function we want to identify then. Well, okay, n-level density function for U of n. Maybe that's more or less what's called the n-correlation, is what's been being called the n-correlation function earlier. Yeah. But I want to call it the n-level density function. And now I want to scale this, scale the thetas and let n go to infinity and see what kind of and see what we get. Okay. And then same thing for the other guys. And now let's talk about large n limits. So this is more or less what I already wrote on the board a second ago, or sort of what I was trying to write over here, I guess. Okay, so suppose you have a sequence. So now let me just set it in kind of a general context where you have an infinite sequence of points rather than a collection of matrices with more and more eigenvalues. But because, I mean, this is what's relevant if you're trying to compare, like, to the zeros of the zeta function. There you've got a string, an infinite string of numbers, and you're trying to compare those statistics to the statistics of what happens when you average over matrices with n eigenvalues and scale and let n go to infinity. So here, suppose you've got a sequence x which does have mean spacing 1. In other words, the nth, let's say these are in order. Well, it doesn't actually. Yeah, no, let's say they're in order, and the nth one is around size n. F is symmetric and rapidly decaying in all directions. And same setup with these b's. And so if you sum over all these b's of f of xb and take the limit as n goes to infinity, and for any reasonable f, if that gives you some gives you the integral of the over r to the n of f against something k, then we should call k the n-level density function. Actually, so I should have called this, sorry. I'm not happy with this k notation. I'm not going to use it really anymore. But anyhow, so that's what we mean there. And so so what happens now for so let's do this scaling now for the unitary. Oops. Okay. So now, so I'm going to use just a tilde on top of the thing to mean that we're scaling. So this is the exact same scaling that John Keating did in his lecture. We want these things to have mean spacing 1, so we multiply all the eigenangles by n over 2 pi. Then we have n, then they vary between 0 and n, and you have n numbers, and so their mean spacing is 1. And so so this is the thing that we want. Okay, that just really matches up with this, except for we're doing it in a different context of we have sort of averages of collections of n things that we're doing statistics on, and taking then the limit as n goes to infinity, and then by Godin's lemma, you get exactly this. Okay, now we've got tilde, so we're applying it to f of theta tilde. Okay, but everything else is just, these are just thetas. And so now we make the change of variable that that let's see that so what's our change of variable here is theta, so let's see, so theta goes to n over 2 pi say theta dashed. So that means that these it's the other way around, right? That's what I was just thinking. Should just look at my slide, yeah? Okay, so theta goes to 2 pi over n theta dashed, and then that makes your theta tilde just go to a theta, right? And so these theta tildes become thetas. Our integration goes from 0 to big N. This becomes, now I'm using the definition, go back to an earlier slide for what SU2N means. It was just SN. Remember, SN is sine N theta over 2 divided by sine theta over 2. And that's the SUN kernel here. And so we replace theta by 2 pi theta over N. Okay, and for the d thetas, then that gives a 2 pi to the n, which kills that 2 pi to the n, and a n to the n, big n to the little n, in the denominator, which I've put inside the determinant. Okay, so this n here came from that change of variables, and the 2 pi got killed also by the change of variables, and here's the thing scaled. And now the point is that limit n goes to infinity of this inside thing, Sn of, let's say, just 2 pi x over n, all that divided by n. Well, let me write that. Okay, so then we need limit n goes to infinity of Sn of 2 pi x over n divided by n, where Sn of theta is sine n theta over 2 divided by sine theta over 2. So this equals limit n goes to infinity of sine, so we have to multiply by n over 2, so just pi x in the numerator, and n times sine of pi x over n in the denominator, and the limit of this denominator is just pi x. So we get sine pi x over pi x, which I've then called f of x. Okay, so that's the so then this determinant then will be the little n, the n level density for u. And let me just complete this with maybe just a couple slides just to wrap this up. So this is the same thing for the other groups, except now you just have an n over pi. Everything goes just the same. At the end, the limit you need is S2n plus 1 pi x over n divided by 2n. Well, I'll leave that for you to calculate that. That's also f of x, same calculation. And then finally, then we have the, so we've computed the modulo of the proof of Godin's lemma. We've proven the n-level density for, this is what you get. Okay, thank you.